Men perched high atop the carriages, street sellers and harlots, policemen and thieves. Chapter 16. London, 1900. The fog was thick and yellow, the colour of peas pudding. It had crept in overnight, rolled down the surface of the river and spread heavily across the streets, around the houses, beneath the doorstops. Eliza watched from the crack between the bricks. Beneath its silent cloak, houses, gas lamps, walls were turned to monstrous shadows, lurching back and forth as the sulphurous clouds shifted around them. Mrs. Swindle had left her with a pile of laundry, but as far as Eliza could see, there was no point washing anything with the fog as it was. What was white would be grey by day's end. It was just as well to hang the clothes out wet but unlaundered, which is what she'd done. It would save the bar of soap, not to mention Eliza's time. For Eliza had much better things to do when the fog was thick, all the better to hide, and all the better to sneak. The Ripper was one of her best games. In the beginning she had played it by herself, but over time she'd taught Sammy the rules, and now they took turns in acting the parts of Mother and the Ripper. Eliza could never decide which role she preferred. The Ripper, she sometimes thought, for his sheer power. It made her skin flush with guilty pleasure, creeping up behind Sammy, stifling a giggle as she prepared to catch him. But there was something seductive in playing Mother, too. In walking quickly, cautiously, refusing to look over her shoulder, refusing to break into a run, trying to keep ahead of the footsteps behind her, as her heartbeat grew loud enough to drown them out and leave her without proper warning. The fear was delicious. It made her skin tingle. Although the Swindles were both out scavenging, the fog was a gift for those river dwellers who scratched a living by unscrupulous means, Eliza nonetheless went quietly down the stairs, careful to avoid the squeak of the fourth tread. Sarah, the girl who looked after the Swindles' daughter Hattie, was the sort who liked to curry favour with her employers by making sly reports on Eliza's failings. At the bottom of the stairs, Eliza stopped and scanned the shadowy lumps and bumps of the shop. The fingers of fog had found their way between the bricks and flattened out across the room, hovering heavily over the displays, clustering yellow around the flickering gas lamp. Sammy was in the back corner, sitting on a stool cleaning bottles. He was deep in thought. Eliza recognized the mask of daydream on his face. With a glance to confirm that Sarah wasn't lurking, Eliza crept towards him. "Sammy," she whispered as she made her approach. Nothing. He hadn't heard. "Sammy!" His knees stopped jiggling, and he leaned so that his head appeared around the shop counter. Straight hair fell to the side. "There's a fog out." His blank expression reflected the self-evidence of this statement. He shrugged slightly. "Thick as the gutter muck, the street lamps have all but disappeared. Perfect for the Ripper." That got Sammy's attention. He was still for a moment, considering, then he shook his head, pointed at Mr. Swindle's chair with its stained cushion, stuck where the bones of his back pressed into it, night after night, when he returned from the tavern. "He won't even know we're gone. He'll be ages yet, and so will she." He shook his head again, with slightly less vigor this time. "They'll be busy all afternoon. Neither would pass up an opportunity to make some extra coin." Eliza could tell she was getting to him. He was part of her, after all. She'd always been able to read his thoughts. "Come on, we won't be long. We'll go as far as the river, and then we'll turn back." "Nearly, nearly. You can choose who you want to be." That did it, as she'd known it would. Sammy's somber eyes met hers. He lifted his hand, clenched it in a small, pale fist, as if he clutched a knife. While Sammy stood by the door, waiting out the 10-second head start always accorded to the person playing mother, Eliza crept away. She ducked beneath Mrs. Swindle's laundry lines, around the ragman's wagon, and started towards the river. Excitement had her heart hammering. It was delicious, this feeling of danger. Waves of thrilling fear crashed beneath her skin as she sneaked along, weaving her way around people, wagons, dogs, perambulators, hazy with fog. All the while her ears were pricked for the footsteps behind her, creeping, creeping, catching her up. Unlike Sammy, Eliza loved the river. It made her feel close to her father. Mother hadn't been one for volunteering information about the past, but she told Eliza once that her father had grown up on a different bend of the same river, had learned his sailor's ropes on a collier before joining another crew and heading for the high seas. Eliza liked to think about all he must have seen on his river bend, round near Execution Dock, where pirates were hanged, their bodies left to sway from chains until three tides had washed over them. Dancing the hempen jig, the old-timers called it. Eliza shivered, imagining the lifeless bodies, wondering what it might feel like to have a final breath squeezed from her own neck, then scolded herself for becoming distracted. It was the sort of lapse to which Sammy usually fell victim. And it was all very well for Sammy. Eliza knew she had to be more careful than that. Now where were Sammy's footsteps? She strained to hear, concentrated her mind, listened. Gulls by the river, mast ropes creaking, hull timber stretching, a trolley trundling by, the flypaper man calling, "Catch 'em alive-o!" The quick steps of a hurried woman, a paper boy singing out the price of his rag. Suddenly behind her a crash, a horse whinnying, a man's voice hollering. Eliza's heart thumped. She nearly turned, ached to see what had happened. Stopped herself just in time. It wasn't easy. She was curious by nature. Mother had always said so. She'd shaken her head and clicked her tongue and told Eliza that if she didn't learn to stop her mind racing on ahead of her, she'd end up running into a mountain made of her own imaginings. But if Sammy chanced to be near and saw her peeking, she would have to forfeit. And she was almost at the river. The smell of Thames mud mixed with the fog's sulphurous odor. She'd almost won. She only had to make it a little further. There was a hullabaloo of voices now, clattering away behind her, and the jangling of a bell drawing near. Silly horse had probably run into the knife grinder's wagon. The horses always went a little mad in the fog. But what a pest! What chance had she of hearing Sammy if he chose to attack her now? The rock wall at the river's edge appeared, floating faintly in the haze. Eliza grinned and broke into a run for the last few yards. Strictly, to run at all was against the rules, but she couldn't help herself. Her hands hit the slimy rocks and she squealed in delight. She'd made it. She'd won. Outwitted the ripper once again. Eliza hoisted herself onto the wall and perched triumphantly, facing the street from which she'd come. She drummed her heels against the rock and scanned the sheet of fog for Sammy's creeping shape. Poor Sammy. He'd never been as good at games as she was. He took longer to learn the rules, was less able to adopt the role in which he'd been cast. Pretending didn't come naturally to Sammy, as it did to Eliza. As she sat, the smells and sounds of the street rushed back upon her. With each breath she tasted the oiliness of the fog, and the bell she'd heard was loud now, coming closer. The people around her seemed excited, all rushing in the one direction the way they did when the ragman's son had one of his epileptic fits, or when the hurdy-gurdy man came to visit. Of course, the hurdy-gurdy man, that explained where Sammy was. Eliza jumped from the wall, scraping her boot on a rock that jutted out at its base. Sammy never could resist music. He was no doubt standing by the hurdy-gurdy man, mouth slightly open as he gazed up at the organ. All thought of the Ripper and the game evaporated. She followed the people who were massing, kept a pace past the tobacconist's shop, the bootmaker, the pawnbroker. But as the crowd thickened, the bell faded, and still no organ music could be heard, Eliza moved faster. A nameless dread had settled in her stomach, and she used her elbows to force her way past other people. Fancy ladies in their walking skirts, gentlemen in morning coats, street boys, washerwomen, clerks, as all the while she scanned for Sammy. Reports were beginning to ripple back from the center of the gathering, and Eliza caught bits and pieces being exchanged in excited whispers above her head. A black horse that had loomed out of nowhere, a small boy who didn't see him coming, the terrible fog. Not Sammy, she told herself. It couldn't be Sammy. He'd been right behind her. She'd been listening for him. She was close now, had nearly reached the clearing, could almost see through the fog. Holding her breath, she pushed to the front of the band of onlookers, and the gruesome scene was before her. She took it in all at once, understood immediately. The black horse, the frail body of the boy lying by the entrance to the butcher's shop. Strawberry hair matted deep red where it lay upon the cobblestones. Chest opened by a horse's hoof. Blue eyes blank. The butcher had come out and was kneeling by the body. He's gone all right. No chance, a little fellow. Eliza looked back at the horse. He was frisky, frightened by the haze, the crowd, the noise, sighing great huffs of hot breath, visible as they displaced the fog a little. Anyone know the name of this here boy? The crowd moved about, jostling as a whole, while individuals turned to one another, lifted their shoulders, shook their heads. I might have seen him round, came one uncertain voice. Eliza met the horse's shiny black eye. As the world and all its noises seemed to spin around her, the horse stood still. They regarded one another, and in that moment she felt as if he saw inside her, glimpsed the void that had opened so quickly she would spend the rest of her life trying to fill it. "Someone must know him," said the butcher. The crowd was quiet, the atmosphere all the more eerie for it. Eliza knew she should feel hatred towards the black beast, should despise his strong legs and smooth, hard thighs, but she didn't. Eyes locked with his, she felt almost recognition, as if the horse understood, as no one else could, the emptiness inside her. "Right-o," said the butcher. He whistled, and a young apprentice appeared. "Fetch the cart and clear the lad away." The apprentice hurried back inside, then returned with a wooden cart. While he loaded the boy's broken body, the crossing sweeper started brooming the bloodied road. "I believe he lives on Battersea Church Road," came a slow, steady voice. It sounded like one of the men at the law firm where Mother had worked. Not a toff's voice exactly, but more plummy than those of the other river dwellers. The butcher looked up to see where it had come from. A tall man with a pince-nez and a neat but worn coat stepped forward out of the fog. "I saw him there just the other day." There was a murmur as the crowd digested this information, looked anew at the small boy's ruined body. "Any idea which house, Governor?" "I'm afraid I don't know that." The butcher signalled to his lad. "Take him to Battersea Church Road and ask around. Someone ought to know him." The horse nodded at Eliza, ducked his head three times, then sighed and looked away. Eliza blinked. "Wait," she said, almost a whisper. The butcher looked at her. "Eh?" All eyes turned to take her in, this speck of a girl with a long plait of rose-gold hair. Eliza glanced at the man with the pince-nez. The lenses were shiny and white so that she couldn't see his eyes. The butcher held up his hand to silence the crowd. Well then, child, do you know the name of this unfortunate lad?
His name is Sammy Makepeace, Eliza said, and he's my brother.
Mother had set coin aside for her own burial, but no such provision had been made for her children. Naturally enough, for what parent ever allowed that such a thing might be necessary?
"You'll have a pauper's funeral out at St. Bride's," said Mrs. Swindle later that same afternoon. She sucked some soup from her spoon, then pointed it at Eliza, who was sitting on the floor. "They'll be opening the pit again Wednesday. Till then, I expect we'll have to keep him here."
She chewed the inside of her cheek, bottom lip pouting.
"Upstairs, of course. Can't have the stink keeping customers away."
Eliza had heard of the paupers' funerals at St. Bride's. The large pit reopened every week, the pile of bodies, the clergyman gabbling a quick service so that he might rescue himself from the dreadful neighborhood stench as soon as possible.
"No," she said, "not St. Bride's."
Little Hattie stopped chewing her bread. She let the lump rest behind her right cheek while she looked, wide-eyed, from her mother to Eliza.
"No."
Mrs. Swindle's thin fingers tightened on her spoon.
"Please, Mrs. Swindle," Eliza said, "let him have a proper burial. Like mother's."
She bit her tongue to save from crying.
"I want him to be with mother."
"Oh, you do now, do you? A horse-drawn hearse, perhaps? Couple of professional mourners? And I suppose you think Mr. Swindle and me should be paying for your fancy funeral?"
She sniffed hungrily, enjoying the sour rant.
"Contrary to popular belief, missy, we ain't a charity. So unless you've got yourself the coin, that boy's gonna spend his after at St. Bride's. Good enough for the likes of him, it is too."
"No hearse, Mrs. Swindle, no mourners, just a burial. A grave of his own."
"And just who do you propose to arrange all that?"
Eliza swallowed.
"Mrs. Barker's brother is an undertaker. Perhaps he could do it."
"Surely if you ask, Mrs. Swindle..."
"Waste a favour on you and your idiot brother?"
"He's not an idiot."
"Stupid enough to get himself trod on by a horse.
It wasn't his fault, it was the fog."
Mrs. Swindle sucked more soup across her bottom lip.
"He didn't even want to go out," said Eliza. "Course he didn't," said Mrs. Swindle. "It weren't his sort of caper. It were yours."
"Please, Mrs. Swindle, I can pay."
Twin brows shot skyward.
"Oh, you can you? With promises and moonbeams?"
Eliza thought of the leather pouch.
I have some coin."
Mrs. Swindle's mouth dropped open and a trickle of soup escaped.
"Some coin?"
"Just a little."
"Why, you sneaky little wench."
Lips tightened like the top of a coin purse.
"How much?"
"A shilling."
Mrs. Swindle screeched with laughter, a horrendous noise so foreign, so raw, that her little girl began to bawl.
"A shilling," she spat. "A shilling won't buy you the nails to drive shut the coffin."
Mother's brooch. She could sell the brooch. It was true Mother had made her promise not to part with it unless the bad man threatened. But surely in a situation such as this... Mrs. Swindle was coughing now, choking on her unexpected mirth. She gave her bony chest a slap, then set little Hattie scuttling across the floor.
"Stop with your caterwauling. I can't hear myself think."
She sat a moment, then narrowed her eyes in Eliza's direction, nodded a few times as a scheme took shape.
"All your begging set my mind. I'm going to see to it personally that the boy gets nothing better than he deserves. He'll have a pauper's funeral."
please, and I'll have the shilling for me troubles. But Mrs. Swindle, nothing. That'll learn you for being sneaky, keeping coin hidden. Just you wait until Mr. Swindle gets home and hears about this, then there'll be hell to pay. She handed Eliza her bowl. Now get me another serving, and you can take Hattie up to bed.
Nights were the worst. Street noises took on a garish quality. Shadows lurched without reason, and alone in the tiny room for the first time in her life, Eliza fell victim to her nightmares. Nightmares far worse than anything she had imagined in her stories. In the daytime, it was as if the world had been turned inside out, like a garment on the line. All was the same shape, size, and colour, but utterly wrong nonetheless. And although Eliza's body performed in the same way it had before, her mind roamed the landscape of her terrors. Again and again she found herself imagining Sammy at the bottom of the St. Bride's pit, lying, limbs askew, where he'd been tossed amongst the bodies of the nameless dead. Trapped beneath the dirt, eyes opening, mouth trying to call out that there'd been a mistake. He wasn't dead at all. For Mrs. Swindle had got her way, and Sammy had received the burial of a pauper. Eliza had taken the brooch from its hiding spot and gone as far as John Picnic's house, but in the end she couldn't bring herself to sell it. She'd stood out front a full half hour trying to decide. She knew if she sold the brooch, she'd receive enough money to bury Sammy properly. She also knew Mr. and Mrs. Swindle would want to know where the money had come from and would punish her mercilessly for keeping such a treasure secret. But it was not fear of the Swindles that decided her. It wasn't even Mother's voice, loud within her memory, making her promise to sell the brooch only if the phantom man came threatening. It was her own fear that the future held worse than the past. That there would be a time, lurking in the foggy years to come, when the brooch was the lone key to her survival. She turned around without setting foot inside Mr. Picnic's house, and hurried back to the rag and bottle shop, brooch burning a guilty hole in her pocket. And she told herself that Sammy would understand, that he had known as well as she did the cost of life on their river bend. Then she folded his memory as gently as she could, wrapped it in the layers of emotions, joy, love, commitment, for which she no longer had need, and locked the hole deep inside her. Being empty of such memories and emotions felt right somehow. For with Sammy's death, Eliza was half a person. Like a room robbed of candlelight, her soul was cold, dark, and empty. When was it that the idea first came to her? Later, Eliza could never be sure. There was nothing different about the day in question. She opened her eyes in the dim of the tiny room as she did each morning and lay still, re-entering her body after the harrowing stretch of night. She pulled back her side of the blanket and sat up, placed bare feet on the floor. Her long plait fell over one shoulder. It was cold, autumn had surrendered to winter, and morning was as dark as night. Eliza struck a match and held it to the candle wick, then looked up to where her pinafore was hanging on the back of the door. What made her do it? What made her reach beyond the pinafore to the shirt and breeches that hung behind? Climb inside Sammy's clothing instead? Eliza never knew, but it felt right, as if it were the only thing to do. The shirt smelled so familiar, like her own clothes and yet not, and when she pulled on the breeches, she savored the curious sensation of bare ankles, cool air on skin accustomed to stockings. She sat on the floor and laced up Sammy's scuffed boots, a perfect fit. Then she stood in front of the small mirror and looked, really looked, as the candle flickered beside her. A pale face stared back. Long hair, golden red, blue eyes with pale brows.
Without letting her gaze slip, Eliza picked up the pair of sewing scissors that sat in the laundry basket and held her plait out to the side. The rope of her hair was thick, and she had to hack through. Finally, it dropped into her hand. No longer bound, the hair on her head fell loose, shaggy around her face. She continued to cut until her hair was the same length that Sammy's had been. Then she pulled on his cloth cap. They were twins. It was little surprise that they should look so similar, and yet Eliza drew breath. She smiled very slightly, and Sammy smiled back at her. She reached out and touched the cold glass of the mirror, no longer alone. Thump, thump. Mrs. Swindle's broom end on the ceiling below, her daily call to start the laundering. Eliza picked up her long red braid from the floor, unraveling at the top where it had been detached, and tied a piece of twine around its end. Later, she would tuck it away with Mother's brooch. She didn't need it now. It was of the past. Chapter 17, London, 2005. Cassandra had known the buses would be red, of course, and double-decked. But to see them trundling by with destinations like Kensington High Street and Piccadilly Circus above their front windows was nonetheless startling. Like being dropped somehow into a storybook from her childhood, or one of the many films she'd watched where black beetle-nosed taxis scurried down cobbled lanes, Edwardian terraces stood to attention on wide streets, and the north wind stretched thin clouds across a low sky. She had been in this London of 1,000 film sets, 1,000 stories, for almost 24 hours now. When she'd finally woken from her jet-lagged slumber, she'd found herself alone in Ruby's tiny flat, the midday sun slanting between the curtains to cast a narrow ray across her face. On the little stool beside the sofa bed, there was a note from Ruby. "Missed you at breakfast. Didn't want to wake you. Help yourself to anything worth scavenging. Banana in the fruit bowl, leftover something in the fridge, though haven't checked lately. Maybe all too gruesome. Towels in the bathroom cupboard if you'd like to get clean. I'm at the V&A until 6. You must drop by and see the exhibition I'm curating at the moment. Something very, very exciting to show you. Ah, kiss. P.S. Come early afternoon. Wretched meetings all morning." So it was at 1 p.m. with her stomach growling, Cassandra found herself standing in the center of Cromwell Road, waiting for the traffic to stop its seemingly perpetual flow through the veins of the city so she could cross to the other side. The Victoria and Albert Museum stood large and imposing before her, the cloak of afternoon shadow sliding rapidly across its stone front. A giant mausoleum of the past. Inside, she knew, were rooms and rooms, each one full of history. Thousands of items, out of time and place, reverberating quietly with the joys and traumas of forgotten lives. Cassandra bumped into Ruby directing a group of German tourists to the new V&A coffee shop. "Honestly," Ruby whispered loudly as they heard it away, "I'm all for having a cafe in the building. I like a good coffee as much as the next person, but nothing gets my goat like people who breeze past my exhibition in search of the holy grail of sugarless muffins and imported soft drinks." Cassandra smiled somewhat guiltily, hoping Ruby couldn't hear her own stomach grumbling at the delicious smells emanating from the cafe. She'd actually been heading there herself. "I mean, how can they pass up the opportunity to stare the past in the face?" Ruby flapped a hand at the rows of treasure-stocked glass cabinets comprising her collection. "How can they?" Cassandra shook her head and suppressed a rumble. "I don't know." "Ah, well," Ruby sighed dramatically. "You're here now, and the Philistines are but a distant memory. How are you feeling? Not too jet-lagged?" I'm fine, thanks.
You slept well?
The sofa bed was very comfy.
No need to lie, Ruby said with a laugh, though I appreciate the sentiment. At least the lumps and bumps stopped you sleeping the day away. I would have had to ring and wake you up otherwise. No way I was going to let you miss this.
She beamed.
I still can't believe Nathaniel Walker once lived on the same estate your cottage is on. He probably saw it, you know, drew inspiration from it. He may even have been inside.
With her eyes bright and round, Ruby hooked an arm through Cassandra's and started down one of the aisles.
Come on, you're going to love this.
With mild trepidation, Cassandra prepared herself to muster up a suitably enthusiastic reaction, no matter what it was that Ruby was so keen to show her.
There you are, then,
Ruby pointed triumphantly at a row of sketches in the cabinet.
What do you think of those?
Cassandra gasped, leaned forward to get a better look. There would be no need to pretend enthusiasm. The pictures on display both shocked and thrilled her.
But where did they... How did you...
Cassandra glanced sideways at Ruby, who clapped her hands together in obvious delight.
I had no idea these existed.
Nobody did, said Ruby gleefully. Nobody except the owner, and I can assure you she hadn't given them much thought in a very long time.
How did you get them?
Purely by chance, darling. Purely by chance. When I first conceived the idea for the exhibition, I didn't just want to rearrange the same old Victoriana that people have been shuffling past for decades. So I ran a little classified advert in all the specialist mags I could think of. Very simple. It just read, Wanted on loan, artistic objects of interest from the turn of the 19th century. To be displayed with loving care in London Museum Exhibition. Lo and behold, I started receiving phone calls the day the first advert appeared. Most of them were false alarms, of course. Great Aunt Mavis's paintings of the sky and the like. But there were pieces of gold amongst the rubble. You'd be surprised the number of priceless items that have survived, despite the slightest care.
It was the same with antiques, Cassandra thought. The best finds were always those that had been forgotten for decades, escaped the clutches of enthusiastic DIYers. Ruby looked again at the sketches.
These were among my most prized discoveries.
She smiled at Cassandra.
Unfinished sketches by Nathaniel Walker. Who'd have thought? I mean, we've got a small collection of his portraits upstairs, and there's some at Tate Britain. But as far as I knew, as far as anyone knew, that was all that had survived. The rest were thought to have been destroyed.
Yes, I know. Cassandra's cheeks were warm. Nathaniel Walker was notorious for disposing of preparatory sketches, work he wasn't happy with.
You can imagine, then, how I felt when the woman handed me these. I'd driven all the way out to Cornwall the day before and had been traipsing from one house to another, politely declining various items that were entirely unsuitable. Honestly, she rolled her eyes skyward, the things people thought might fit the bill would amaze you. Suffice to say, when I arrived at the house, I was just about ready to call it quits. It was one of those white seaside cottages with the grey slate roofs, and I was on the verge of giving up. When Clara opened the door, she was a funny little thing, like a character out of Beatrix Potter, an ancient hen dressed in a housefrau's apron. She ushered me into the tiniest, most cluttered sitting room I'd ever seen, made my place look like a mansion, and she insisted on making me a cuppa. I'd have preferred a whiskey at that point, the day I'd had, but I sank down into the cushions and waited to see what utterly worthless object she was going to waste my time with.
And she gave you these.
I knew what they were immediately. They're not signed, but they've got his embossing stamp on them. See, in the upper left-hand corner. I swear, I started to shake when I saw that. Nearly knocked my cup of tea all over them.
But how did she get them? Cassandra asked.
Where did she get them?
She said they were amongst her mother's things, said Ruby. Her mother, Mary, moved in with Clara after she was widowed and lived there until she died in the mid-60s. They were both widows, and I gather they were good company for one another. Certainly, Clara was delighted to have a captive audience to regale with stories about Mother Dearest. Before I left, she insisted on showing me up the most perilous flight of stairs to take a look at Mary's room. Ruby leaned closer to Cassandra. What a surprise that was. Mary might have been dead for 40 years, but that room looked as if she was about to arrive home at any moment. It was creepy, but in the most delicious way. A slim little single bed, still made up perfectly, a newspaper folded on the bedside table with a half-completed crossword on the upper sheet, and over beneath the window was a little locked chest. Tantalizing! She finger-combed her wild grey hair. I tell you, it took every bit of restraint I could muster to resist tearing across the room and ripping the lock open with my bare hands. Did she open it? Did you see what was inside? No such luck. I remained mercifully restrained and was ushered out a few moments later. I had to content myself with the Nathaniel Walker sketches and Clara's assurances that there'd be no more like them amongst her mother's things. Was Mary an artist too? Said Cassandra. Mary? No, she was a domestic. At least she was to begin with. During the First War, she'd worked in a munitions factory, and I think she must have left service after that. Well, she left service in a manner of speaking. She married a butcher and spent the rest of her days making black puddings and keeping the chopping boards clean. Not sure which I'd have liked least. Either way, Cassandra said, frowning, how on earth did she get her hands on these? Nathaniel Walker was famously secretive about his artwork, and the sketches are so rare. He didn't give them to anyone. Never signed contracts with publishers who wanted to retain copyright of the originals. And that was the finished artwork. I can't imagine what would have made him part with unfinished sketches like these. Ruby shrugged. Borrowed them? Bought them? Maybe she stole them. I don't know, and I must admit I don't much mind. I'm happy to chalk it up to one of life's beautiful mysteries. I just thank God she did get her hands on them, and that she never realized their value, didn't find them worthy of display, and was thus able to preserve them so beautifully for us through the entire 20th century. Cassandra leaned closer to the pictures. Though she'd never seen them before, she recognized them. They were unmistakable, early drafts of the illustrations in the fairy tale book. Drawn more quickly, the lines scratched eagerly in an exploratory fashion, filled with the artist's early enthusiasm for the subject. Cassandra's breath shortened as she remembered feeling that sensation herself when she began a drawing. It's incredible having the chance to see a work in progress. It says so much more about the artist, I sometimes think, than the finished work ever could. Like the Michelangelo sculptures in Florence. Cassandra looked sideways at her, pleased by Ruby's perspicacity. I got goosebumps the first time I saw a picture of that knee emerging from the marble. As if the figure had been trapped inside all along, just waiting for someone with enough skill to come and release him. Ruby beamed. Hey, she said, alight with a sudden idea. It's your only night in London. Let's go out to eat. I'm supposed to catch up with my friend, Gray, but he'll understand. Or I'll bring him, too. More the merrier, after all. Excuse me, ma'am, came an American accent. Do you work here? A tall, black-haired man had come to stand between them. I do, said Ruby. How may I help? My wife and I are mighty hungry, and one of the guys upstairs said there was a coffee shop down here. Ruby rolled her eyes at Cassandra. There's a new Carluccio's near the station. 7 o'clock, my shout. Then she pressed her lips together and forced a thin smile. Right this way, sir. I'll show you where it is.
When she left the V&A, Cassandra went in search of a delayed lunch. She figured the last meal she'd eaten must have been the aeroplane supper, a handful of Ruby's licorice all sorts, and a cup of tea. Little wonder her stomach was shouting at her. Nell's notebook had a pocket map of central London glued inside the front cover, and as far as Cassandra could tell, no matter which direction she took, she was bound to find something to eat and drink. As she peered at the map, she noticed a faint Biro cross, somewhere on the other side of the river, a street in Battersea. Excitement brushed like feathers on her skin. X marked the spot. But which spot exactly? 20 minutes later, she bought a tuna sandwich and a bottle of water at a cafe on the King's Road, then continued down Flood Street towards the river. On the other side, the 4 smokestacks of Battersea Power Station stood tall and bold. Cassandra felt an odd thrill as she traced Nell's footsteps. The autumnal sun had come out from hiding and was tossing silver flecks along the surface of the river. The Thames. What a lot the river had seen. Innumerable lives spent along its banks. Countless deaths. And it was from this river that a boat had left all those years ago, with little Nell on board, taking her away from the life she'd known, towards an uncertain future. A future that was now past, a life that was over. And yet it still mattered. It had mattered to Nell, and it mattered now to Cassandra. This puzzle was her inheritance. More than that, it was her responsibility. Chapter 18. London, 1975. Nell tilted her head to get a better view. She had hoped that by seeing the house in which Eliza had lived, she might somehow recognize it, feel instinctively that it was important to her past. But she did not. The house at number 35 Battersea Church Road was utterly unfamiliar. It was plain, and for the most part looked like every other house on the street. 3 stories, sash windows, thin drain pipes snaking up rough brick walls that time and grime were turning black. The only thing that set it apart was an odd addition at the top of the house. From the outside, it appeared that part of the roof had been bricked in to create an extra room, though without seeing it from inside it was difficult to know. The road itself ran parallel to the Thames. This dirty street with rubbish in its gutters and snotty children playing on its pavement certainly didn't seem the type of place to spawn a writer of fairy tales. Silly, romantic notions, of course, but when Nell had imagined Eliza, her thoughts had been fleshed out with images of J.M. Barrie's Kensington Gardens, the magical charm of Lewis Carroll's Oxford. But this was the address listed in the book she'd bought from Mr. Snellgrove. This was the house where Eliza Makepeace had been born, where she'd spent her early years. Nell went closer. There didn't seem to be any activity inside the house, so she dared to lean right up against the front window. A tiny room, a brick fireplace, and a pokey kitchen. A narrow flight of stairs that clung to the wall by the door. Nell stepped back, almost tripping over a dead pot plant. A face at the window next door made her jump, a pale face framed by a corona of frizzled white hair. Nell blinked, and when she looked back, the face was gone. A ghost? She blinked again. She did not believe in ghosts, not the sort that went bump in the night. Sure enough, the door to number 37 Battersea Church Road swung open with mighty force. Standing on the other side was a miniature woman, about 4 foot tall, with pipe-cleaner legs and a walking stick. From a raised mound on the left of her chin came one long silver hair. "Who are you, girlie?" she said in a muddy Cockney voice. It had been 40 years at least since anyone had called her girlie. "Nell Andrews," she said, stepping back from the wizened plant. "I'm just visiting, just looking. just trying to... She held out her hand. I'm Australian.
Australian? Said the woman, pale lips drawing back at the sides in a gummy smile. Why didn't you say so? My niece's husband is Australian. They live in Sydney. You might know of them. Desmond and Nancy Parker?
Afraid not, said Nell. The old woman's countenance began to sour. I don't live in Sydney.
Ah, well, said the woman somewhat skeptically. Perhaps if you ever get there, you'll run into them.
Desmond and Nancy. I'll be sure to remember.
He don't get in till late most times.
Nell frowned. The niece's husband in Sydney?
Fellow what lives next door. Quiet for the most part.
The woman dropped her voice to a stage whisper.
Might be a darkie, but he works hard.
She shook her head.
Fancy that, an African man living here at number 35. Did I ever think I'd see the day? My ma'd roll in her grave if she knew there was blacks living in the old house.
Nell's interest was piqued. Your mother lived here too.
That she did, said the old woman proudly. I was born here, that very house what you're so interested in, matter of fact.
Born here? Nell raised her eyebrows. There weren't many people who could say they'd lived their entire life in the one street. What's that? 60, 70 years ago?
Nearly 78, I'll have you know.
The woman jutted her chin so that the silver hair caught the light.
Not a day less.
78 years, said Nell slowly. And you've been here all that time, since, a quick calculation, since 1897.
I have, December 1897. Christmas baby I was.
Do you have many memories? From childhood, I mean.
She cackled. Sometimes I think they're the only memories I got.
Must have been a different place back then.
Oh, yes, said the old woman sagely, and that's a fact.
The woman I'm interested in lived on this street too. Here at this house, apparently. Perhaps you remember her? Nell unzipped her bag and withdrew the picture she'd had photostated from the frontispiece of the fairy tale book. Noticed that her fingers were trembling slightly. She's drawn to look like a fairy tale illustration, but if you look closely at her face... The old woman extended a gnarled hand and took the proffered image, squinted so that rows of wrinkles gathered around each eye. Then she started to cackle.
You know her?
Nell held her breath.
I know her all right. I'll remember her to me dying days. Used to frighten the bejesus out of me when I was a littlin'. Told me all sorts of wicked stories when she knew my ma weren't around to give her a poundin' and send her scuttlin'.
She looked up at Nell, frowning so that her forehead concertinaed.
Elizabeth? Ellen?
Eliza, Nell said quickly. Eliza Makepeace. She became a writer.
Wouldn't know about that. Not much of a reader myself. Can't see the point of all them pages. All's I know is that the girl there in your picture told stories to make your hair stand on end. Kept most of us local kids frightened of the dark, though we was always coming back for more. Don't know where she learned the likes of them herself.
Nell looked again at the house, tried to get a sense of this young Eliza, an inveterate storyteller, scaring the younger children with her tales of terror.
We missed her when she were taken.
The old woman was shaking her head sadly. I'd have thought you'd be pleased not to be frightened any more.
Not likely, said the old woman, lips moving as though she were chewing her own gums. There ain't a child alive what don't enjoy a good scare now and then.
She dug her walking stick into a spot on the stairs where the render was crumbling, squinted up at Nell. That girl herself got the worst sort of scare, though. Far worse than any of her tall tales. Lost her brother, you know, one day in the fog. Nothing she could tell us was as ghastly as what happened to him. It was a big black horse, trod right through his heart. She shook her head. The girl, she were never the same after that. Went a bit batty, you ask me. Cut off all her hair and started wearing breeches, if I remember properly. Nell felt a rush of excitement. This was new. The old woman cleared her throat, withdrew a tissue and spat into it. Continued as if nothing had happened. There was a rumour going round she were taken to the workhouse. She wasn't, said Nell. She was sent to live with family in Cornwall.
Cornwall?
A kettle began to whistle from inside.
That's nice then, isn't it?
I imagine it was.
Well then, the old woman said with a nod towards the kitchen, that's tea time.
The pronouncement was so matter-of-fact that for a brief, hopeful moment, Nell thought she might be being invited inside, offered tea and countless other anecdotes about Eliza Makepeace. But when the door began to close, the old lady on one side and Nell on the other, the fond fancy passed.
Wait, she said, pushing her hand out to hold off the closing door.
The old woman held the door ajar as the kettle continued to shrill. Nell pulled a piece of paper from her handbag and began to scribble on it.
If I write down the address and phone number of the hotel I'm staying at, will you contact me if you remember anything else about Eliza? Anything at all?
The old woman cocked a silvery eyebrow. She paused briefly as if sizing Nell up, then took the piece of paper. Her voice when she spoke was slightly changed.
If I think of anything, I'll let you know. Thank you, Mrs. Swindle, said the old woman. Miss Harriet Swindle. Never met a man I'd let make me his own.
Nell lifted a hand to wave farewell, but old Miss Swindle's door was already closed. As the kettle finally stopped shouting inside, Nell glanced at her watch. If she hurried, there was still enough time to get to the Tate Gallery. There she could see Nathaniel Walker's portrait of Eliza, the one he'd called the authoress. She pulled the little tourist map of London from her bag and ran her finger up the river until she found Millbank. With a final glance down Battersea Church Road, as a red London bus shuddered past the banks of Victorian houses that had played host to Eliza's childhood, Nell set off. And there she was, the authoress, hanging on the gallery wall. Just as Nell remembered her. Thick braid slung over one shoulder, frilly white collar buttoned to her chin so that her fine neck was encased, hat on her head. Quite different from the sorts of hats usually worn by Edwardian ladies. Its lines were more masculine, its pitch more jaunty, its wearer irreverent somehow, though Nell wasn't sure how she knew that. She closed her eyes. If she tried hard enough, she could almost remember a voice. It came to mind at times, a silvery voice, full of magic and mystery and secrets. But it always slipped away before she could clasp the memory to her, make it her own to command and recall. People were moving behind her, and Nell opened her eyes again. The authoress came once more into frame, and Nell walked closer. The portrait was unusual. For one thing, it was a charcoal sketch, more a study than a portrait. The framing was interesting too. The subject wasn't facing the artist, but had been drawn as if walking away, as if she'd turned back her gaze only at the last minute and been frozen in that moment. There was something engaging in her wide eyes, her lips parted as if to speak, and something uncomfortable too. It was the absence of even the hint of a smile, as if she'd been surprised, observed, caught. If only you could speak, Nell thought. Then perhaps you could tell me who I am, what I was doing with you, why we boarded that boat together, and why you didn't come back for me. Nell felt set upon by the dull weight of disappointment, though what revelations she'd imagined might be gleaned from Eliza's portrait she didn't know. Not imagined, she corrected herself. Hoped. Her entire quest was based on hope. The world was an awfully large place, and it wasn't easy to find a person who'd gone missing 60 years earlier, even if that person was oneself. The room was beginning to empty, and Nell found herself surrounded on all four sides by the silent gazes of the long dead, all observing her in that strange, heavy way the portrait subject has, eyes eternally watchful, following the voyeur around the room. She shivered and slipped on her coat. The other portrait caught her eye when she was almost at the door. As her gaze fell upon the painting of the dark-haired woman with pale skin and plump red lips, Nell knew exactly who she was. A thousand snatches of long-forgotten memories combined in an instant. Certainty flooded every cell. It wasn't that she recognized the name printed beneath the portrait, Rose Elizabeth Mountrachet. The words themselves meant very little. It was more, and it was less. Nell's lips began to quiver, and something deep inside her chest clenched. Breathing was difficult. "Mama," she whispered, feeling stupid and elated and vulnerable all at once. Thank God the Central Reference Library was open late, for there was no way Nell could have waited until morning. Finally she knew her mother's name, Rose Elizabeth Mountrachet. Later she would look back on that moment in the Tate Gallery as a birth of sorts. Swiftly, with neither warning nor fuss, she was someone's child. She knew her mother's name. She said the words over and over as she scurried along the darkening streets. It was not the first time she'd heard them. The book she'd bought from Mr. Snellgrove, with its entry on Eliza, had mentioned the Mountrachet family. Eliza's maternal uncle, minor member of the aristocracy, owner of the grand estate in Cornwall. Blackhurst, where Eliza had been sent after her mother's death. It was the link she'd been looking for. The thread that tied the authoress of Nell's memory to the face she now recognized as her mother's. The woman at the library desk remembered Nell from the day before, when she'd come searching for information on Eliza. "Did you find Mr. Snellgrove, then?" she said with a grin. "I did," said Nell, rather breathlessly. "And you lived to tell the tale? He sold me a book that was very helpful. That's how Mr. Snellgrove always manages to make a sale." She shook her head fondly. "I wonder," said Nell, "if you could help me again. I need to find some information on a woman." The librarian blinked. "I'm going to need a little more to go on than that." "Of course. A woman born sometime in the late 19th century. Was she a writer too?" "No, at least I don't think so." Nell exhaled, collected her thoughts. "Her name was Rose Mountrachet, and her family were aristocrats of some kind. I thought perhaps I might find something in one of those books, you know the sort, with details of members of the peerage." "Like Debrett's, or Who's Who?" "Yes, exactly." "Worth a look," said the librarian.